some of the things that you see throughout the country and how much we wish to see that get things fixed, where all the schools have resources and equipment, where you go even to the deepest rural corner of our country and find that there are suitable teachers there, there are resources and there our learners are given an equal opportunity and chance to education as all others, even in urban areas. So today we'll be taking that topic here today with the plans that the department is having and also where we commended the department for opening up even the rural education.
In introducing this, Chair, we just want to remind members that the conceptualization of the campaign itself came about as a result of the level of illiteracy that was recorded in the sense of the census of 2001, where at that time we had 9.6 million of the adults that were functionally according to the book. And of that number, we had about 4.7 million who could not read and write. And this report came amidst the declaration that as a country, we were member states to your United Nations Millennium Development Goals, where the declaration was, among others, to reduce poverty, and also the UNESCO one, where the declaration was to halve the level of illiteracy by 2015. So as a background, we are also referring to the efforts that were made immediately after 1994 to try to address the issue of illiteracy in the country. I'm not going to go through that. But what is important to know is that all these efforts did not bring any significant drop in the level of literacy in the country. As a result, then the cabinet approved the curriculum strategy, which was proposed by the ministerial committee on illiteracy, or on literacy for that matter, and ultimately even the rollout plan. And this way, this led subsequently to the launch of Kalibude campaign in 2006. And these are other models that were taken into consideration as the Kalibude was conceptualized. And the aims and scope of the campaign aims to teach people to read and write in mother tongue, to use spoken English to develop number concepts, and also to achieve an equivalent of grade 3, which is your ABET level 1 qualification. The scope of the campaign was going to cover all 11 official languages, and it covered illiterate other learners who are 15 years and over in online programs. And amongst others, it also provides learners with literacy and numeracy materials. And what makes or what made the campaign to work? Success factors were reflected on that, and key among them would be the ministerial roadshow that we spoke about in our last presentation. And this is the institutional arrangement at DBE level, as well as the level of provinces and down there at the level of district. And Kalibude unit, we tried also to reflect on what each and every one of the components is responsible for. We have the Kalibude unit at DBE level. We have field operations, which we call your coordinator structure, and management of the program, which has been outsourced. Implementation of the program, we have already reported on the enrollment in terms of the number of learners, which up to so far we are saying total enrolled from the start of the campaign to date is about 4.3 million. And then learners per sector, we looked at two sectors, that is your disability structure as well as your non-disability structure. And we can report that out of the 4.3 million learners that have been able to enroll in this campaign, we have 31,786 of them belonging to the disability structure. And then in terms of gender, out of the total number of learners that we have so far, we have been able to enroll 52% of the total number as female learners. The recruitment of volunteers, we have for 2016, we have been reporting on the other, but for 2016 we have to indicate that we have about 14,767 volunteers. And per sector as well, we have those that belong to the disability structure, and altogether it's about 7,947 of them. And the total number of the recruited volunteers up to so far is 341,087. Then per gender as well, in terms of the volunteers, 26% of them are female volunteers. And we also reflecting on the LTSM that has been provided to the learners in this campaign, in terms of items, to say what items have they been receiving on a yearly basis. Assessment, it is important to note that these learners are also tested, like you would in a normal or in mainstream school. They are being tested, and they also have what you call learner assessment portfolio, which each and every one of them will have. And these are being mapped, these are being verified, these are being moderated, like you would deal with each normal assessment processes. And once the marking has been done and the moderation, then there is a process of verification which is done by the South African Qualifications Authority. And once the labs have been submitted and verified, then what the South African Qualifications Authority does is to put these learners on the National Learners Record Database, which is managed by the South African Qualifications Authority. Learners are encouraged to register for IEC at the Department of Higher Education Community Colleges once they have completed level one, other level one. Achievements of the campaign, I'm not going to go through all of them, but just to indicate that so far we have been able to register 4.3 million of the 4.7 million that we were targeting. And job opportunities have been created for about 341,087 volunteers, and that amounted to a stipend of about 2.9 billion that we have been creating so far. But also of note is the fact that with the experience that these volunteers would have gathered during the campaign, we were able to have 217 volunteers who have been awarded Kunzani Shaka Bursary to study to become teachers. And through the National Learners Record Database, Karikude graduate contribution to the country's sixth grade is recognized. Then I'm not going to go through the awards that have been received by the campaign itself. We reflected on this in our last report. And other projects as well, we are not going to talk about this because we have already done that. Now we also want to reflect on the progress that we have made with regard to our response to the AG's queries. Chair, as you rightly indicated, in our last report, we indicated that there's a 44 million fruitless expenditure that was incurred by the campaign. So I wanted also to reflect on the progress to say that an amount of 202,297 was found to have been paid to fraudulent volunteers. That is after we had done our own internal investigation. And the action that followed thereafter was for us to to set up processes to recover the amount that was fraudulently paid to the volunteer. And so far, we can report that we have been able to recover 281,838 of that amount, which actually translates into 99.8%. That's what we have been able to recover so far. The other issue was for us to respond to requests for documents for verification by the office of the Auditor General. We have been able to provide these documents to the office of the Auditor General, and that was done as early as in December. But unfortunately, the office of the Auditor General only collected the documents around February 2017. So we are still awaiting the result of their investigation with regard to the 6,172 cases that were linked to the 44 million fruitless expenditure. Now, the department has since appointed Springbo Consulting Group Company to independently investigate and validate the 44 million query by the Auditor General. Now, the progress in terms of that is that we have been able to provide Springbo with the whole database of the entire population of the year under investigation. And the DBE received the report on the 24th of February 2017, and the report is currently in process internally. Now, there's another action where we had to follow up on the recommendation which was made by the SCOPA that we involve the Hawks in the whole matter. And the response that we have from the Hawks is that this matter does not belong to the Hawks, but instead it belongs to the other unit, which is your asset and professional protection. Financial implications, we are here reporting on the actual expenditure, as you can see, from 2008 up to 2015-16. These are the amounts, most of them would be around half a billion. And in as far as Karikude unit is at DBE is concerned, this is where we are in terms of total expenditure from 2008 up to 2016. Then again, the Karikude field operations, expenditure thereof, we should cover things like the stipend, LPSM, and so on. So this is where we are. As you can see, the expenditure is quite high. It's just in every year, we have been around half a billion in terms of expenditure. Then this is the budget for this year, in which the budget was 415 million. And this is where we are. We are at 7.6%. But as you can see, with the compensation of employees, we are overspending, but that will be balanced out in terms of the savings that we are going to make in as far as the KRG campaign is concerned. And EPWP incentive grant has also been used. As you would know, that this campaign is a campaign that was also aimed at creating jobs. So we had also to use this other platform in order to pay the stipend. So the amount that we have received up to so far in terms of the EPW incentive grant, we have been able to show it since 2011-12 up to 2015-16. And the phase-out plan, I'm not going to go through the other details, but just to say that it is important for us, as we close the campaign, to ensure that for 2016-17, the classes get started. Of course, they started on the 1st of November 2016, so it will be ending 23 March 2017, and that will be for your non-disability structure, but for the disability structure, they will end on the 4th of May 2017. And SACA will be starting with the process of verifying, moderating and verifying the elapsed in July 2017. And this is just a summary of the phase-out implementation plan, where we start by ensuring that we complete the process for the current financial year, and we submit the financial statements. We wrap up the campaign in terms of the assets, in terms of the materials and archiving, and submitting financial statements for 2018, and addressing also aging queries, and the closeout report, which should be available around 2017 December. And the HR exit and placement strategy has been completed, and that was completed as early as November 2016, and consultations with affected individuals have already been completed. And then the presentation of the closeout report to HEPCO and all the other structures will be done by October 2017. So I'm not going to, this will just be the details of the summary that I provided, and this will then be put in front of the committee to note and discuss the project from its inception up to its final. Thank you. On this one, there was an investigation that was done internally. Just looking at the 6,172 cases that were identified and reported on by the AGIS office. Now, what we did was to take the very same cases internally and interrogate them, and we found that there are indeed cases where volunteers were paid fraudulently, and that amounted to 280,000. And the action that we then took immediately was to say, now let us recover that money. So what we are reporting on here is the fact that we have been able to recover almost 99.8% of the money that was found to be fraudulently.
Thank you very much, thank you very much from the department for the presentation. The Chairperson, carried good program has achieved its objectives for everybody to can witness. One of its objectives was to even assist the learners with disabilities. As we are wrapping up the program, what are the plans in place to assist those smaller numbers that have never benefited from the program? I'm referring more especially to those living with disabilities. Some of them we know that they were hidden by their families. They cannot be taken out to go and be assisted. Will this program be able to take another form to at least assist those who are left out? but not by by the system. I'm not saying they were left out by the system, as I've indicated after they were hidden. What are the possibilities, Chair, to divert the budget to look on the many disabled learners who are being left out? Many are in informal institutions across the country. We all know they are not being well taken care of, since many learners are said to be in a waiting list in the public institutions. And with this waiting list, we do not know as to when are they going to be absorbed and be taken care of in such institutions. Thank you very much.
I also would love to welcome the and also thank you, Department, for the job well done and all the achievements that you acquired throughout the world service. You have absolutely never looked at it and achieved on the issue of the disability adjustment, they are still, I think, from 2008, when I see the different trends were increasing, but when it got into 2016, it declined. So if I can ask what are the reasons for the declination, were you able to work with the disabled formation to assist in the provision of the service? Then, with the same question, do you work with other departments collaboratively to work on this program? And I don't know, I haven't, this program is going to, the last year. What new form, what new shape is this program going to take? Is there any plan so that continuous assistance in this system? Then on the issue of the food test wasteful expenditure, I'm happy that you have been able to and recover this money's owed. That's a problem to take. But did you hold any person responsible? Because it was, in this case, not incorrectly or mistakenly paid, but fraudulently paid. Did you hold any person responsible for them in terms of criminalizing the system? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you very much for the presentation. This is a very noble program, and it seems to have done a good job in expanding literacy and numeracy in our country, so we support the program. I just want to follow on from what my colleague just said about the fraudulent volunteers, the findings of the Auditor General. You say that there were 6,172 cases. I just want to also repeat his call to find out what action has been taken against those who were found guilty of fraud. But it also leads me to a little bit of confusion, because if the Auditor General has evidence and findings of this fraud, and you yourselves have admitted that there was fraud, why then do we need an independent consultant to do another investigation to validate the findings of the Auditor General? If you're already admitting fraud and the Auditor General found evidence of fraud, why then do we have an independent consultant? Also, you say that the Hawks have referred this to the Assets Forfeiture Unit, or at least they've told you that that's the best body to deal with it. But obviously the Assets Forfeiture Unit is only really mandated to recover assets that are the proceeds of crime. So that would also suggest that a crime has taken place. So again, why do we need another consultant to do another investigation? That's what I'm finding a little bit confusing. The SABNT was the service provider that was found to be involved in this irregular expenditure, and their management fee, according to the Auditor General, was found to be fruitless and wasteful expenditure as a result. But we saw last year that their contract was extended to September 2017. Can you shed some light on why the contract for SABNC was extended, given their involvement in the fraud that was uncovered by the Auditor General? And then lastly, Chair, I just want to ask about the 400,000 who didn't benefit from the program. You, in your presentation, said that 4.3 million of 4.7 benefited, so that leaves with 400,000. I know that there's probably been some people who have been deceased in that time, but is there anybody who is deserving to be on this program who hasn't made it onto this program? And what is the plan for them going forward? Thank you.
Thank you. Another question?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Peter. Previous speaker has already covered in more special that at that level that I'm not yet there. Coming to this session because you have this problem. I commend the department for the effort that we have made to recover the money and the amount of money that we have identified that has been volunteered that was the site fraudulent. Now you have 0.167 that is outstanding, of which 0.16% can be have you identified the problem on where
covered, but I'd just like to ask a question with regard to the enrollment of learners and per sector. We do see that it is a significant drop. And if we have a look at the enrolled learners per sector, I would like to see a report coming out as to why the drop was so significant, because I am of the opinion that learners experienced a lack of enthusiasm, because we know in the education field for learners who are deaf and blind, we don't have enough educators. So I doubt whether we had competent trainers to assist our blind and deaf learners. And another aspect that I would like a report on is the LTSM for the blind and the deaf. We know that many of our schools that cater for these learners do not have LTSM. So I doubt whether these learners had it as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. To a large extent, I've been covered by colleagues that have asked questions for me. But I'll start off by also complimenting the department for this project. It was a very big project, and for people who started with 4.7 people who read and write, it's quite an achievement that those close the trail off the wall with the bus staff only about 400,000. But one wonders whether nothing could be done for them, whether we really had to wrap up this year. Are we leaving them out, or didn't they show interest or what? My big concern, though, is that the report emphasizes the people, number of people who enrolled. So we do not have a clear picture of how they performed in the program. Here and there were those duos who performed exceedingly well and are going to continue. But lastly, we just don't know what happened with the people who enrolled. Did they all complete the course? Then coming to the auditor's report, I would need help because I didn't quite understand it when the report says 98% of the fruitless expenditure has been recovered, and that has amounted to 282,297 rand. But I thought the report was saying millions. Maybe I had wrong. Unfortunately, I didn't receive the copy. So if I could get clarity, the millions had been had disappeared through wasteful or fruitless expenditure, and only 2,082 recovered from volunteers who were fraudulently paid, and this amounts to 282,000. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I wonder whether it's in this presentation that I have is page 5, but it's the one that is speaking about numbers of number of learners and multiple teaching. I want to check on the issue of counting. That we are indicating that the number of learners in primary schools is this number, is a million couple. Learners in multi-graded teaching schools is 739, but the percentage is 0%. Is it a misprint or what? So can I check with that? Because I think it's worrying me. And also, I'm worried about the on page 9. The slides are not numbered yet. That might correct. Also, teachers and public advisors supported. There's an indication that in Northern Cape, there were no teachers that were supported. What was the reason? Thank you, Chair. I don't want to repeat what the others have said. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Mabuya, I think you are all commenting the progress and very good achievements which we have heard and seen when it comes to the Kakura project.
I think it was something else that I was asking.
What you should say, I guess. I was saying, it's a good job, well done. But I think from all of us, what we are interested in knowing is what might be your relationship then with the Department of Higher Education, because with such good work that has been done, laying this background, giving all these South Africans the NQL level 1, it would be a good thing to see them progressing to other levels. And you know very well that now they are with IET, higher education and training. So that transition, that I might call it articulation, it's fine. How are they going to articulate? Is there any program or talks between the two departments so that we don't see such good work in Pelele Moyeni, these people doing nothing now? Let us see them progressing when it comes to that. With the 44 million, I think Honorable Mark has covered me very well, because I had the same question. We even went to school last year, you know how, you know. So with the report, we say what happened, we have recovered something. What is it exactly? That is why I needed you to go back to that slide, but I just said, no, fine. I will ask a question at the end to say, what is it that you have recovered? What is outstanding? Going back to the Hawks, not because that was a recommendation from our committee, Ms. Bonchofa, Hawks not wanting to come in. Why? It's because it's leaking that is left, or what? Just a clarity around that, because I think in this whole project that you are very excited about, but that cloud is still hanging over it. Once you can clear that, then I think everyone will be satisfied. Can I mention your motion?
Thank you, Chair. Maybe I should just jump to the question, because there was a lot of emphasis on certain areas of the report. The first one being that one on the decline in terms of the enrollment. Now, if you look at the slide on the enrollment, there is a general decline, even in terms of your non-disability. Because as you are going towards the end of the program or the project, obviously you would have covered a lot of scope. So as we go towards the end, then you will have fewer enrollments. And that shows even in terms of the number of volunteers. The volunteers, when we started, they were around 40-something thousand. But for this year, because now we are nearing the end of the project, we are about 40,000. So it's because we have almost covered, you know, the targets that we have set ourselves. Now, with regard to the plans, especially with regard to learners with disabilities going forward, I think what the department is doing is to try to be proactive, to make it a point that we have, for instance, what you call the 3-3 model, where we are going to have programs that will be able to cater for learners even before they get to that age that we are setting up. Remember, yes, we were talking about adult illiteracy. So to care for the issue of adult illiteracy going forward, especially in the disability sector, this is a program that we are trying to bring to you. But I must also indicate that we have been able to secure a conditional grant that will be linked to the program for the severe intellectually disabled children. So that grant will make it a point that we become proactive in ensuring that after the 15-year-old age, then you don't have to struggle with issues of addiction. And what is it that we have in place? For now, we do not have anything in place to replace the candidate campaign as it was, or as it is, in its shape and form. But we have other programs that will try to compensate for candidates. And with regard to the amount that we are talking about, the fruitless expenditure amount. Yes, Honorable Davis, we reported on 44 million as our fruitless expenditure. But we have always disputed the amount. We even said it at our meeting with the COPA, where we said we do agree that there could be fruitless expense. What we did not agree on is the extent. Hence we said, much as we suspect that there could be fraudulent activities that could amount to fruitless expenditure, we want to make sure by having an internal investigation, which was done by DPD, we
investigated, and the amount that could be associated with fruitless expenditure was only 200 and something, as per our internal investigation.
Something thousand.
That's the amount that we could find to be associated with. Internally, we were able to go to the 6,000 this and this cases, one by one, and try to identify areas where people could have been fraudulently paid. And that amounted to 200. This is the amount that we said we need to recover from the volunteers who were fraudulently paid. And that will only be part of the 44 million. Now the 44 million, we said, now let's get it independent because we are disputing that amount. So we got the independent firm to do the investigation. And maybe it's premature for me, Chair, to report that in actual fact, much as I indicated in the report, that we are still doing internal processing of the report. But the report that we have from the independent firm indicates that the amount that actually amounts to fruitless expenditure is only 1.2 million, not 44. We had to sit down with the auditor general, Honorable David, around the table and try to explain to them how the campaign works, especially with regard to the payment of the stipend. What the auditor general had done, the auditor general looked at cases of deceased learners. Say for instance, a volunteer had 12 learners in class, then two of them were deceased. What the auditor general did was to say, this person shouldn't have been paid because now it's no longer 12 learners, it's 10 learners. Now we had to show them the sliding scale that we are using to pay the volunteer, in which case we would say, if you've got a maximum of 18, this is the amount that you get. If you have only 40, this is the amount that you get. If you only have 10, this is it. So we had to show them that scale to say that even if you have deceased learners, which is happening even in your normal setup, it doesn't mean that the class has to be closed down. You still continue to teach the learners who are there. But the payment will not be the same, because now we are paying on a sliding scale. That's where the problem was with the issue. We sat down with them. Out of that meeting, I was able to show them how they erroneously calculated the 44 million. Now, once they realized that there's a deceased learner, then they would say, to whom is this deceased learner linked? Right? If it's linked to Honorable David, then they would say, Honorable David, who shouldn't have been paid this amount of money for the duration of 6 months of the campaign. So that's how they came to 44 million. The 44 million was based on only 6,000 cases which were associated with learners who were. All along, even before we went to the COPPA to the COPPA, even the AG was not convinced of what we were saying. Until we came with all the documents and showed them that, no, we paid this person because the approved sliding scale for the stipend allows us to pay this person, even if this person is having less than the initial amount. However, what we are saying is, we have cases where, for instance, you would have a volunteer who was paid despite the fact that there were no learners at all. And that's according to our own investigation. And that is the amount that amounted to about 200 and something. I'm sure now everybody should be understanding. Now the 98% recovery that we are talking about is not recovery from the 44 million. It's the recovery out of this, the investigation that we did, based on 6,700 cases that we have. Now, But I must also indicate that with the independent firm, they did not only focus on 6,000 this case, they took the entire population and investigated thoroughly the payment. And that's how they came to 1.2 million. I hope that is sufficient.
Now, thank you very much, Dr. Mokar, for that. I think it's even asked us more because we're going to the end of the financial year, the beginning, we're still going even to the end of this, because even with them, these are questions and the clarities that we need to see this to say what brings them to, what brought them to that. So, so thank you very much. It's not at the end that we talk about it, we're still going to be even in that office. So, surely some of the things that will come.
And then I'm going to request Dr. Ramadomo to speak to the issue of the LTSM material for the disability sector, as well as what is it that we are doing with regard to the other remaining cases relating to fraudulent payment.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Ma'am, concerning the LTSM for the blind and the deaf, our materials, all of them, for all languages, have been translated into Braille for the blind and deaf. When the campaign started, the department bought a Braille embroider, which is placed, it is with the Council for the Blind. It belongs to the department. That's where we print material for the blind learners. The deaf learners use the same material that we use, but in English. So LTSM is being addressed, and the trainers, the curriculum, and all users are educated people with metric methods that are training the learners that are in the blind learners. And then concerning fraudulent actions that are taking place, the legal section within the department is working with the service provider and us to address the issue. So you might get a report in June 1st.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that is how we are addressing the issue. The other issue that relates to learners that have completed curriculum is that we have been discussing with the Department of Higher Education. We gave them a list of all the learners and all the volunteers that have been to curriculum to link up with them for where the policy learning centers are. And we gave them this disaggregated that according to municipalities on the ground. That has been submitted to the Department.
Thanks, Dr. Chair, I think there's another question that's related to SABNT. So saying, why did we have to extend the contract? I need to remind members that the issue of SABNT was not necessarily with regard to the fruitless expenditure, but it was a link to irregular expenditure. Simply because of the supply chain protocols that were followed in their appointments. So it wasn't necessarily with regard to the $44 million, but it was around the outcome. appointment of SAB. And this only came later when we had already extended their contract.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mabuya. Though for me on this one, on excellent treatment, yes, we are saying you are recovering the money that you will pay fraudulently. In no way where we say all the time we must be punitive, but at the same time, the consequences must be felt. Because for me, on these fraudulent payments, yes, the committee, these are volunteers. If Honorable Baston, Honorable Kosa, Honorable Davis has claimed, all of them have claimed fraudulently, you know, they got those payments. For me, they did not do that on their own. I'm their leader and their head, maybe. I assigned even my signature for that. Yes, you can recall the monies that have been given to them, but at the end, when we talk of excellence, how are they getting the lessons to say we have promised the government, we have promised the department? So I think you did not get into that as to say, so that we must learn lessons, you know. It's a painful exercise, yes, that you have taken back the money. Maybe that is how you look at it at the end of it. It's fine, but we just wanted to know really what is it that you do, so that these people do not just do the same thing, they do not process the government moving forward. This is the public health, and it's something that you don't want to see happening in future.
Thanks,
Chair.
I think in this case, the department really found itself in a very dicey situation where you had to take disciplinary measures against the people, but at the same time, you need to recover. So what has happened now, we are following up on the cases through the legal service. Because if you just decide, for instance, to expel these people, then the chances are you will not be able to recover the money that you are supposed to recover. So there are two processes, recovering, but at the same time, looking at taking disciplinary measures against it. So it's quite a dicey situation. Otherwise, if we had decided outrightly that we are going to expel these people, we wouldn't have been able to recover anything.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the clarity around the AG report. Now, it's a bit concerning to me that the AG pronounced on this in the department's annual report that there was 44 million rands of irregular expenditure. And now you are saying that you sat down with the AG and you persuaded the AG that actually it was far less and that your own consultants find that it was 1.2 million. Now, I guess I'm a bit concerned as to why the AG wasn't made aware of this before the annual report process, and why the AG didn't perhaps consult with you, or whether you didn't provide them with the information in good time, so that we could have avoided the perception that there was this wide-scale corruption in the program. So I'd like your comment on that, please. So why did it even make its way into the annual report and into the Auditor General's statement? If it's not true, then at the moment it's very much your word against the AG. You're saying that the AG has made a mistake, but the AG is not here to speak on its own behalf. Will there be an AG report on this? Will the AG essentially, will they retract what they've said about this program? Or how can we get official confirmation from the Auditor General that the fraudulent activity that they identified wasn't on the scale that they originally thought it was? So I think it's important for us to get finality on that. You can't just take your word for it. Obviously, you have your own interest in this regard, because you are the department. And we need a truly independent body to pronounce. And at the moment, we only really have your word and your independent consultant. Just on the independent consultant, can you give us some background as to how you appointed the, I think it's called how was that consultancy appointed? Did it go through a tender process? And then just following up on what the chair said about the action taken, I appreciate what you say about this dicey situation, as you call it, because you need to, on the one hand, discipline the guilty parties, but you also need to recover the money. But in my mind, surely the way forward is to prosecute these individuals, because they have been involved in criminal activity. If they've defrauded the department from money, it is criminal. So surely the way forward is to lay charges against them or to prosecute them, and then to recover the money through the usual legal processes that you take when somebody has been involved in fraud. And that's why you bring in the asset forfeiture unit, presumably. Because once parties are found guilty, then the asset forfeiture unit moves in to recover the money. So my question to you is, is there going to be a criminal investigation into these individuals, and is it being initiated by the department as a first step? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair, once more. I think I was very careful to indicate that perhaps I'm saying some of the things prematurely when we're still awaiting the report from the independent firm. In fact, not awaiting, but we are internally processing it, because it still has to be reported to the other structures before it can come to the committee. Definitely, there is going to be a presentation on the report that will be tabled before the committee. So maybe we can just be patient a little bit. That report will definitely be meeting. And the AG story. Well, for now, it is my word against the AG's word. It's true, but we must admit that before this went into the report, the annual report of the department, the colleagues inside were trying to explain this thing, but I think our engagement was not convincing enough until we drew some documents to show how the payments were made and trying to link that to the scale that we are using for payments. But even the chairperson of the conference, I think he was on our case to say, how come you have put this into your report when you have not verified and validated? It was raised. And the DG said, we avoided an issue of where we would be in the situation of the other department. Which department was it? Was it environmental affairs? Which was there because they had not yet submitted their annual report. So we were avoiding that, only to find that we were actually sort of compromising ourselves in a way by stating this amount and actually admitting that this is the amount that is correct in terms of irregular expenditure. So I'm sure Heather indicated that we are awaiting the report from the AG. That report from the AG, probably it will also outline the processes that they went through when they came up with the 44 million, and probably also even show us that indeed this is where we went wrong. So can we also maybe be patient to wait for that report from the AG? As I indicated, we gave them all the documents, the CDS, in December, but they only collected them. The documents were ready for collection, but they only collected around late February. So probably they are still working on those documents. And in that case, it's easy because they are only working on about 6,000 cases that they had investigated in their past. Whereas the other firm did the entire population. As to the appointment of Sengo, this was not advertised because, as you would know, if any amount that is involved is less than 500,000, then you simply have to draw up your solicitation and ask for quotation. So that's how it was appointed, that framework. And the other question is about the way forward, which I think is a point taken. We take that point to say that we really have to go the harsher route of instituting criminal charges. And I'm sure that's what our legal section is working on. Thank you.
So we always say we're closing, we're wrapping this, but we also say that there will always be these things that keep on popping up. We are going to be engaging in the agent's office, and it's not for the last time again that we hear of this topic because with all the investigations and reports that we are still waiting for, as a committee, we still wish to hear you coming to present to us on the final closure of the project. But thank you very much for that. Honourable Member, let's go to the presentation on drug education. Dr. Jones, I will hand over to you again, Dr. Mbuya. So much.
Thanks, Chair. As I indicated, Dr. Langa will be taking us through the presentation. Over to you, Dr.
Good morning, honourable members. This is just quickly the outline of the presentation. Okay, this is just to indicate that our focus on rural education is our response to the NDC that talks about reducing poverty and inequalities. Hence, the DBE now has this mandate for focusing on rural education. And we just wanted to...
Now filling it up at 11.
Okay, we just wanted to quickly give a landscape on rural education just to show how many rural schools we have in the country. And here we indicate that 47% of our schools are rural, with Limpopo and KZN leading. And the second one, because most of our multi-grade teaching schools and the schools that we support in the directorate are multi-grade schools, we also wanted to give an indication of how many multi-grade teaching schools we have in the country, which is 20% of our schools. And also the next one is the learners. I'll just quickly go through the support that we give to these rural schools. And the first one is professional teacher development, where we're focusing on three things. We're giving support to multi-grade teaching schools where teachers and subject advisors were trained and on the teaching and also on the multi-grade school kits and the special one on school-based assessment. And the next slide indicates what it is that we trained teachers and subject advisors on multi-grade teaching, and as we can see, it includes pedagogy, classroom management, and also ICT use in multi-grade classes. And the DBE developed a toolkit, a multi-grade toolkit, which assists teachers to teach in multi-grade classes, rather. And the training that was done also to subject advisors. In that one, we were training the trainer so that they go to provinces and also train subject advisors and teachers in multi-grade teaching schools. And this slide indicates the number of subject advisors that have been trained thus far, and the teachers as well. And they were trained in all subjects in all three phases, foundation, intermediate, and senior. And the e-learning support as well. The first column gives us the number of rural schools that are targeted for this phase one project. And all the schools that are indicated here were given ICT trolleys that had the following. It's 24 tablets, one data projector, a printer and tablet and laptops rather for teachers. And a server with preloaded content for grade R to grade 12. And the server consisted of this digital content. And this is the percentages, the graph that shows the percentages of schools that have been supported so far. supported in the form of LTSM, in the form of workbook, also here from grade 1 to grade 9. And here we give you a graph on rather the number of schools, of rural schools, primary and secondary, that have been provided with this workbook. Okay, and the next part rather of the support is teacher recruitment strategies and incentives. Our main projects that we have at DBE on teacher recruitment and teacher retention in rural areas is the Funza Lushaka Battery Program. The Funza Lushaka Battery Program is basically where we recruit students from mainly rural schools. Our target is quintal 1 to 3 schools, and we know that most of these schools are in rural areas. We do target quintal 4 and 5 in recruitment as well, but we concentrate on learners who come from disadvantaged backgrounds. It's mostly learners who are exempt from paying school fees. That is how we target, or we ensure that it's learners who come from from disadvantaged backgrounds rather. And this bursary scheme is supported by the district-based teacher recruitment campaign and the community-based teacher recruitment campaign as well, which means we involve both the schools, the district rather, and the schools as well as the community when it comes to campaigning for this bursary scheme. So far, 2,000 Funza Lushaka bursaries have been ring-fenced for this recruitment campaign. And like I've explained already, we target quintal 1 to 3 and a little bit from quintal 4 to 5. But when it comes to placement, all the schools, all the students rather who have graduated are placed in rural schools. And so far, this is how the batteries have been allocated. And you can see that some of the provinces get more allocation than the others. This depends on how many quintal 1 to 3 schools the provinces have. As you can see, Eastern Cape is leading, KZN also followed. Okay, I've already explained this. Okay, this is the implementation approach. It starts from determining the needs up to the placement of the students, and support is given all the way. This one reflects or shows us how many students or how many learners have been recruited and how many we have at the moment in tertiary institutions. It's the input in 2013 and the output in 2017 that is shown in a different color. And this is in the form of a graph, and it's the management plan. I'm not going to go through that. And the teacher incentives one, this policy on teacher incentives, it did implicate on rural school teachers as well, because it's basically for recruiting, or rather for assisting with retention in schools where it's difficult to recruit and to retain teachers. And this includes schools in remote areas, and this will include rural schools as well. It also includes, and our conditions include staff skills, subjects, and it also includes generally schools that are finding it difficult to recruit. They can certainly motivate for also the teachers to also get the incentive. That is why then we find that this becomes a very contested, there are many challenges around the teacher incentive, because although the conditions are clear, but again provinces have to deal with needs versus affordability, where although, I'm just making an example, in KZN where they've chosen that they're going to use remoteness as a condition for getting an incentive. But if there are more teachers in rural, in deep rural schools that they've identified, then they move from the no fee, they move from rural to general rural to the no fee schools. If again there are more teachers in the no fee schools, then they move from no fee to quintiles, where you'll find that although they said all no fee school teachers, all teachers who teach in no fee schools will get the incentive, but then they have to limit the numbers by identifying just one quintile, and they've settled with quintile 1, which is why we find a lot of challenges or complaints from teachers saying there are schools that are getting a full repair across the road, but another one is not getting, which is down the road. It's because of how provinces choose how would give this incentive. And this just gives us that the idea of which provinces choose which system. There's only one that chose the SAS skills, and that is Mpumalanga. And two provinces are not providing teacher incentives. And we come to the rural education policy. There is currently a research team that is developing a rural education policy for us. It was appointed by the minister, and it has taken longer than anticipated because of the fact that rurality on its own is a very complex phenomenon. We call it a phenomenon deliberately. So they started in March 2013. We have six members of the research team, the reference team as well, and the secretariat. But what we can say is that the process has been very consultative, and also the research team has been working closely with officials from DBE and officials from provinces as well. So the process has not only been consultative, but it has also been guided closely by DBE and TGs to make sure that the process speaks to the needs of the sector. This is the process, and it shows that it's been very consultative. And the team did present the preliminary findings to the minister on the 20th of January, and they are now concluding the writing of the policy, and hopefully they'll be given a deadline of the 31st of March. Okay, and under rural education collaborations, we have ultra, intra, and interdepartmental collaborations. Within DBE, there is a multidisciplinary rural education committee where we ensure that all directorates within DBE report on this, on the rural education directorate, on the work that they do to support rural schools. And we also present to them our plans and our interventions and programs on rural education. We have a new team, the agriculture team, that is looking at agricultural education and how we can change that, or if there is a need to change that, so that it responds to the changing labor markets in the country and to the needs of the country in general. We have the Interprovincial Rural Education Committee as well, made up of PED officials. All provinces are represented, and again in this one we share with them the work that DBE does to support rural schools, and they also report on what they do as provinces to support these schools. We have collaborations that we formed with the Department of Science and Technology, which is called the Hydro Alternative Energy Project, and we also are in partnership with the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Rural Development and Land Reforms on the establishment, focusing on the establishment of a self-sufficient agricultural model school that we hopefully are going to have soon. We have collaboration again with BMW to establish a BMW Academy of Excellence. British Council also supports us with SBAP. And these are the meetings, group of meetings that we've had around these collaborations. And the last slide is to the plans that we have for DBE to implement some of the plans that we've shared with you. I think Thank you.
contact.
Thank you, Chairperson. I reinstate my questions that I asked earlier on. And I want to check with the multi-grade. Do we, as the system, see ourselves doing away with the multi-grade classes? And I also want to check with the issues of the incentives, which is very problematic when we look at it, because as you rightly presented, you find a school across the road getting the incentive, and the other one, then we look at the issues of remoteness. Are both schools not remote?
why are they quintiled differently if they belong to the very same community? So if you can be able to assist in that one, that if perhaps we are quintiling the schools, can they all be quintiled the same in one segment? Because it's the very same parents that are parenting those kids that are in those different schools. I think let me leave for others to check everything.
But you know what other people are saying, just like when it's time to step, you know, you just want to get into that thing and cut out everything that everyone wants to do today.
Thank you very much, Chair. Do you know what I have picked up on oversight is that our learners are coming out of school without the basic three R's. They cannot read, they cannot write, and they cannot do arithmetic. And maybe we should lay the blame at the door of DBD or training colleges or universities. But teachers do not have the basic pedagogic and content knowledge competence. So they cannot impart their skills. I don't know what we're going to do to be able to see to it that these necessary skills are given to our teachers. And then what we found as well is that insufficient organizational support for teachers, district and circuit, don't get to these rural and farm schools. If they do, it's once a year, twice a year maximum. And another aspect that we've picked up as to why rural learners are doing badly is the late coming and the absenteeism of our educators. And if we had a more what word could I use? Direct impact from district and circuit, this could be addressed. And another aspect is the vacancies. We must have a look at the vacancies, Chair, and then the lack of basic amenities, infrastructure and learning resources are absolutely shocking at some of the rural schools. As a teacher, I would hate to wake up in the morning to go to those schools, let alone the learners that have to go there as well. What I would also like to see is that in rural areas that we start identifying one-stop centres. This could assist to impart skills not only to our learners but to our parents as well on school programs. My colleague Koto spoke about the ICT. Another aspect that is worrying is in the rural areas we sit with land issues because of private authorities. Could this not be the reason why we do not find educators of substance because of not being able to get accommodation suitable? Another aspect that has to be looked in, I don't know if it's increased, but I remember when I was still in the teaching profession, 900 rand was paid as a housing allowance. There is no way somebody is going to be able to afford proper accommodation on 900 rand. You cannot even pay rent with 900 rand. And then, Chair, district education forums is a must. In rural areas, it is a must. And then I would also like to know, from the Lushaka, you say that you identify students from the rural areas. What systems are in place to ensure that these rural students remain in the rural areas? If I am to be given a bursary and I start teaching in a rural school and I see what the circumstances are like, I'm definitely going to start reapplying and ask for a position in another place. Chair, for now, I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson.
go to us on the incentives. I do hear that at least they are given something like money for them to be kept there. My understanding is that it's not only money that can make us happy. One of my friends, Chairperson, was, you know, when you have this vacancy list, it was distributed to all schools, then applied not knowing the school. But when he was taken, the circuit manager introduced him to the most remote area. It was his last day that day. It was his last day after he was introduced. Yeah. You know why, Chairperson? Accommodation. Accommodation. Because he asked, where am I going to accommodate here? Nothing. No way. Comparing with other departments, you know, when you are employed, others are given even child, something to replace when he's employed. With us, you are just employed, introduced with the teachers. See for yourself how you fend. Transportation. You know, a remote place, you know, with a problem when you have to get to towns and the like. In the place where I was working, you know, we were both teachers who are staying 100 kilometers from where the schools are. Amen. They are working in Pulus. Very rural, very remote Pulus. They are using their own truck every day, traveling 200 kilometers a day. So you see, if nothing is done to those teachers, we may lose them because they may be taken next to the townships. Even the same of if we can look at accommodation and transport, then technology has been touched. We check even technology. Because you get into a weapon through Eastern Cape. There is very, we have to, you see, to climb on a tree just to get one bar. You see? So we look at that, I think we've got to touch on that one. The implementation. You see, most of the provinces have said remoteness, and all Pumala have said scarce skills. I have a problem when we don't implement this thing on the same note. Another one says scarce skills, another says, well, what do you mean by scarce skills? Because if it's Siswati in our place, it's scarce. It's very scarce in the mother tongue, very, very scarce. It's very difficult to get our language, Zulu, a teacher teaching Zulu. Very difficult. Deep down, you remember the issue of colleges. So how do you determine this is scarce, this is not scarce? If we can implement it in the same way. And we have got even this, we have got stakeholders. For example, teacher union. They will come with this, knowing what Zulu Natal says, what that, yeah, you say, then you are causing great confusion, you see. So you know, this thing must be done the right way. Then the issue of the, I think Honorable Khoza has taken me up, same school in the same vicinity. They are even separated by a fence, the canoe fence. But this one gets the rural, this one doesn't. And you say, no, because that one, no, it's a challenge. Then again, what we should be using, not Pella, we must develop department. Let us develop that. You know, when you go to Arab states, we know that it is very, very hot, very, very hot today. But they are using the same heat for their own benefit. They will put a masola, they will develop something up here. See, now we say, no, they are very rural. Why can't they ensure that the same ruralness works on the benefit of the same schools? We push more on agriculture. Push more on agriculture. Very, they have a post there. They plow there. They have got animal, what do you want to think?
understand, or kids and wife, they do the same things. You know, there are teachers who want to do those things, but if they are not supported, they just give everything to them. We make sure within agriculture works on their benefit. They are the one who are supplying this what we call supermarket. Let me stop the checkers in.
Thank you, Chair. It is reported that the provinces choose a criterion to regard the incentives. My question is, I don't have a problem with that, but is it done in accordance with the province if they are allowed to say to choose their own group? The other frustrating issue is when the honourable member has said that, you know, if two schools are separated by a fence, then we want to take the other as not being rural. How do you explain that to the educators? Thank you.
I will advise the department just at least to be fair. Let us evaluate as well the situation, like it has the previous speaker has said, where the fence is only a line that is separating the two schools, but they are being done differently. Let us evaluate them. I like the criteria of because those are also schools that are not easy to reach. They are disadvantaged. I'm sure that's why KZN is the one that is having the most. Because those learners are really disadvantaged. Now, how do we justify the types of incentives that are needed by these different types of programs? That is, this one only needs resources, this one only needs money, it's in the seat, this one needs transport, different types of resources. understand this incentive implementation is a policy, the incentive policy. But you find provinces that simply don't fit to implement it. Gauteng and Northwest, maybe Gauteng is not that able. So, do we leave them as just they don't have money? And then they might. So, whereas this is a policy, how strict are we in our implementation of policy? And then how do we, not Richard, do we accommodate the special schools in that area? Because we find it unfair that learners, because they are living with disabilities, and then they are taken to cities to access education because they are not special schools in rural areas. Just have in mind a grade A learner or a grade 1 learner and so forth. Let alone.
I think it's fair to say that our rural education is in a crisis. You just need to read NEDU's report on rural education to see that, and you just need to visit a handful of schools, as we did in KwaZulu-Natal at the beginning of the year, to see that. I think what we find from our side is a distinct lack of urgency, both on the ground, within the provincial departments, amongst the circuit managers, amongst the district directors, and even here, amongst the representatives from the DBE, when we go through these presentations, there seems to be a level of complacency, which I personally find unacceptable. And there just doesn't seem to be the urgency required and the innovative thinking required to turn the situation around. That's my overall comment. I want to echo what my colleague said about the allocation of bursaries of province. When these bursaries are allocated, are they ring-fenced in such a way that if you come from the Eastern Cape, for example, you then have to teach in the Eastern Cape? Or can you study at any university and go to any province afterwards? Because I think a big problem is student teachers who go to universities in urban centres and they don't go back to the rural areas, and we hear that a lot on the ground. And in that regard, is there any plan to teach student teachers where they live if they come from rural communities? Can we not implement distance learning programs very effectively in rural areas so that people who come from those areas stay in those areas, they do their practicals in the community that they come from, and they are encouraged to stay and teach and give back to the communities that they come from? I wonder if there's any plan in that regard. When it comes to the teachers' incentives, you identify that there's been some, it's been implemented inconsistently across the 9 provincial departments. And you single out 2 provinces in particular, the Gauteng and the Northwest, who are not implementing the policy due to financial constraints. My point there is that surely all the provinces, when it comes down to it, would argue that they have financial constraints. The question is just whether they have the political will to implement the policy and to reroute money from other programs and put it into this program. So it's really about their priorities as a province. It's not just simply that these 2 provinces have financial constraints that other provinces don't have, because I'm sure that Limpopo, the Eastern Cape, and Mpumalanga, and many other provinces have probably more financial constraints, arguably, than Gauteng and the Northwest. So what is really the problem in Gauteng and the Northwest? It cannot simply be due to financial constraints. The other delay is have to do with reaching consensus within the provincial bargaining chambers. Could you just briefly outline for us what are the sticking points at the provincial bargaining chambers? What are the sticking points that are preventing the policy from being rolled out? Then just on another concluding comment. I think the fact of the matter we have to agree is that we're just not simply producing enough quality teachers. And my colleague also made this point. And when we go into the rural areas, we find a particular shortage of good maths and science teachers. For example, we went to Setu Secondary School in KZN. And you know, this is a school where not a single learner passed maths in the trick, and only 9% passed maths literacy. And when we interrogated this a bit further, we found that the maths teacher who's teaching the grade 12 only has a matric. You've got no post-school qualification whatsoever. So of course, as long as that teacher is in that school teaching, that those learners are not going to be able to pass maths because they're not getting the instruction that they rightly deserve because their teacher simply isn't qualified to teach them. So what are we doing to turn this situation around, the situation whereby you have teachers who simply aren't qualified to teach learners in rural areas? I'm not talking about long-term strategies of supply and demand of teachers. What immediate things are we looking at to do? Because we could go on recruitment drives, for example, to headhunt teachers from other countries. Often when we go to rural schools, I hate to say it, but the fact is often, and I don't want to generalize, but often the maths and science teachers, the schools that get good maths and science results have teachers from other African countries, from places like Zimbabwe, Congo, Ghana, Malawi. What are we doing to actively recruit excellent teachers, for example, from around the continent, our rural areas to drastically improve the performance? Is there any plan to do that? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Davis. Honourable Slam.
I'm covered.
Okay, I'm covered. Thank you, Honourable Slam. Dr. Langa, in the support that you mentioned, I heard one where you said giving support to them in terms of what is. My question is, are those workbooks different from the workbooks that are given to other schools? If so, what is it that is entailed in those workbooks? I've never came across any of those materials, so I became very interested to hear what is it that you are talking about today. The one for Bursa's Quintal 1 and 2-3 really is quite good, but I think honorable members have covered me very well on those ones, because I also wanted to know the main interest is to say, once they've been given those Bursa's, how to make sure that they teach where they're supposed to teach. It's not for the first time that the committee even discussed that. As to say, with the doctor or whatever, it's what we call community service, where there's a bit clear where they are compelled to go and pay back to the state. Can't we have something like that even with education? Because by so doing, we'll be laying the students' backgrounds in those rural areas. So that's why I say it's not for the first time, really. Maybe we need to get a progress report as to say, when you plan around this, what is it that you we are planning as the department to make sure that we hold to those students that we give this money to pay back to the community. But looking at the results, matric results specifically, because that is how most of the time we do what you are doing in the system. It's quite good that we see a lot of in the results. Though I'm happy again that you department, you even said the manner that you are going to be reporting now will be more analytic so that we can zoom and go straight and to say, when we say we see that improvement,
in quintile ones and two and three. What are we talking about? Subject to subject, the quality thereof. Because for now we might be having that good report to say yes, there is improvement, but to talk to the issue of improvement as such as to say what is it that you are talking about. Maybe as we move forward, that is what you are going to get, because this issue of educators that are not well skilled really might be affecting the quality, but looking forward and hope that is going to we are going to be getting that. Lastly, it has been a challenge for many years when you sit even in your chamber with the labor unions as to say how do we define the rurality of the schools, more especially for incentives issues. Now we have got the directorate. Where is that? Are we having now a clearer definition when we say, when you talk of rural education, this is what you're talking about? When we talk to the issues of incentives, I know most of the time we're thinking of the financial incentive, of which I think from the discussions, the honorable members were putting clearly that you let us not only focus on the financial aspect of it, but there's so much that is involved. But that has been what has been mostly contested here today. We see other provinces not getting into it. Some they implement it and they have to withdraw due to the contest that the provinces get from the social partners when it comes to the issue of defining that. So how far are you? What argument and understanding you have or that is there in the provinces when it comes to that issue? Because for me, I really want to cross that bridge again. It should be easier moving forward. Okay, can we then hand over to you, then, Dr. Mbuli?
All right. Maybe let me just respond to some of the questions and already others. When Dr. Langa was then filling in. With regards to ICT training, there is widespread acknowledgement. ICTs are in England, and of course they are more relevant than anywhere else in the rural areas. Very relevant, because those are your remote areas, and then with ICTs you are able to promote access. What I need to mention here is that with regard to ICTs, especially under operation assistance, we are providing what you call an end-to-end solution, where we don't just provide devices without connectivity or even without teacher development. So it's a pity that in this presentation we could not include teacher development ICT integration, but it is part of the end-to-end solution that we are providing to our students through what we call the universal service access obligation. This is an obligation to all the network providers to ensure that they provide this to all the schools. So all the schools, including your rural. So all the schools are covered. Yes, indeed, this is phase one. And phase two will probably cover other rural schools that were not covered in testing. But teacher development is an integral part of the whole package. And we particularly look at the integration of ICT in teaching and learning. That's what we're doing. The eradication of multi-grade classes, I think this issue has been debated extensively. And multi-grade teaching has got its pros, has got its cons. It's got its own advantages. Especially now that it is even difficult to conclude the process of measure and rationalization
So it looks like Maxi Grade teaching will be with us for some time. In actual fact, we have seen it even moving towards multi-phase teaching rather than being totally eradicated. The policy on incentives, which is what the message that we are trying to convey here, the policy on incentives is not necessarily only for rural schools. It applies across. It depends on the criteria. And provinces will choose to say which criteria are they focusing on. But when you look at the issue of remoteness, indeed, the issue of gap fill is implied. Because the more remote you are, even your best teachers would not want to go there. So it's actually embedded in that. And with the policy on rural education being finalized, definitely we have to have those criteria that speak directly to rural education so that they are also part of that policy. Perhaps I should also mention that when it comes to your scarce skills, even in urban areas, we're still struggling to retain those teachers. Hence, we have to provide this as one of the categories for incentives. Because these are teachers or educators who can easily be absorbed into industry because of the scarce skills that they are offering. So that's why the incentive policy is not only focusing on rural education. The issue of the quintiling or quintile system. The quintile system is problematic, we must admit. And indeed, we have taken note of the fact that it even now affects the provision of education for rural schools. And it affects mainly the issue of incentives when it comes to rural education. And this is something I think that we also have to factor into the policy. So we are taking note of this. The three R's, there's no dispute around that. And I must say that this cut across. It's not only with regard to the rural school. The issue of content, the issue of pedagogy is a problem. And that problem stems probably from the fact that we have closed down teacher colleges. And the type of products that we get from universities are not really sufficiently equipped to can assist the. But what we are doing in the meantime, we are also having what we call continuous teacher development programs to ensure that where there are gaps, at least we are able to cover them. And teacher development has also come up with a strategy in terms of the induction program so that each and every teacher who gets into the system will then be subjected to a very intensive induction program. We should be able to cover all the deficiencies that we have already identified with regard to universities. In essence, universities, I think there's an acknowledgement once more that universities are not our best place to train. Universities are mainly for research and not for any other purpose. They are places where we produce knowledge more than anything. So, yes, indeed, we acknowledge that there is a problem with 3R, and that has occurred. Insufficient support to and monitoring of rural schools. That has been identified. Through our oversight process, we have also identified that very little is done to support and monitor these schools. So we have even come up with ways of dealing with that. Instead of, because of the limited resources, instead of your monitors going to those schools, they'd rather convert at a central place whatever
documents that we need from the school who could be brought to that area where sufficient monitoring can be done. Those are some of the strategies that we are coming up with to ensure that at least those schools are also being monitored. And I think the issue of district support and monitoring is also acknowledged in the NDP to say that not enough support is being given to our schools. Not necessarily now it becomes worse with your remote and rural schools, but generally our support systems are not yet strong. But there is a lot that is being done to try to cover up. The issue of the one-stop center, that the hub idea of having hub for your rural schools within a particular locality, I think this is something that we are looking at. As I indicated, that we are already working on a model where there will be some hubs where you can always call your rural principal, your rural teacher to those centers, but also the centers that could be well equipped. So that whatever materials that are not there in the school, they can be found in the school. And district education program, that's a very good initiative that we are taking into account. Categorization, I think we've already spoken to that, to say, with a policy that is being developed, and which is developed by people who are quite conversant with the issue of ruralness, I think we'll be able to come up with something that will address a lot of issues that have been raised here. And the deficiency model that you are talking about, that we should move away from looking at the rurality as a barrier rather than looking at it as an enabler. That's one of the things that was discussed in the roundtable discussion before we had this research team that is working on the policy. And that definitely will be effective. And you have areas where I think this is being implemented already. I know for a fact that somewhere in the Free State, there are what you call your rural villages, where they bring everything there so that, you know, ruralness does not become a hindrance. Rather, it becomes something that you can tap into. Queen Tiny was already special schools. Coincidentally, most of our special schools would be found in what we previously called our Bantu Center, and those would be our rural areas. So there is accommodation in those rural areas for them. The only issue that we have with the special education and the accommodation of these learners, even learners from your urban areas, is the fact that there's forever this long waiting list. So for learners to be placed, to be processed, and they still have to wait for them. So what is in essence this is saying is that we do, the bottom line is we have a shortage of special. The categories of incentives, I think I've already spoken to that. Honorable Davis, lack of agency, that's a point which has been made here, and probably it's because of the delay in the finalization of the policy. What will also make the processes to be very slow could be the fact that we have not as a country come up to a definition of what ruralness means. So that in itself remains a problem, because what you think is rural might not be rural to someone until we come up with a definition. And this is what the policy is going to come to say in education, when we talk about ruralness, this is what we are saying. And the ring-fencing of this bazaar, when you look at the graph, this
passing on your printer 1 to 3 only started in 2013. That's when it started. That intake of 50-13 is only producing 493 in that bar graph. So it's only after 4 years that we have the outcome or the output of the strategy. Now what remains to be seen, as the chairperson indicated, is where these learners are going to be placed, because we were targeting students who would be placed in those attempts. So this is the program. They have not yet been placed because this is the beginning of the year. And then when they get placed, I think it would be important for us to get a report. Then we can check whether that strategy has made an impact in the right direction. And I must also indicate that we have a pilot that we are running. Again, I know of a pilot that is running in the food state, where we are doing this in partnership with Save the Children. The model that is being used there is that of district-based teacher recruitment. It's under the strategy of the state. Now we have students that we have recruited, but these students are not going to be full-time. They are doing distance learning. So they are doing distance learning while they are already working in the school. So they are sort of based in school, getting the necessary experience while in the meantime they are doing distance learning, and I know they are doing that through this. So these are some of the strategies that are already in place. The willingness of politicians, I think, is very important for us to take rural education to another level. Bargaining chamber, we have also indicated that the issue of incentives is about priority. And as you would know, priorities will differ from one person to the other, or from one sector to the other. Whilst we want to prioritize this, then it might be that with the unions is something else. So that's why there is always that element of conversation around what to prioritize and not to, what not to And the workbook chair that we are using are the very same workbooks that have been given to ordinary schools. Because these learners in rural schools are doing the very same curriculum that is done by others. So we are talking about the same workbook. But it was important for us to reflect as to how many of these schools have been provided with the On that note, I will also ask Dr. Lando where I have not been able to sufficiently cover the questions. But let me also indicate that one of our strategies, which is still around the issue of balance, especially when it comes to scarce skills, is to say we are working with an organization called TeachSA, Teach South Africa, where they have a pool of students who have done very well in terms of scarce subjects, your BSCs, your this and this, especially in math and science. That pool, as a department, we do tap into that pool to place these learners in areas where there's a need. But this, again, is incumbent upon the provinces. The provinces are the ones who decide to take them or not to take them. I know for a fact that the beginning of this year, we were able to place about 80 in Gauteng and KZN. So we are still awaiting the other provinces to request the placement of these learners, of these students. Now the idea is to have these students that we are placing in school, they do the teaching, but probably their experience in assisting in schools will translate into their love for teaching, and in that case you'll be able to give them a 1-year qualification, which is called your PGCE, and that is how we want to close the gap in terms of the scarce skills, using the very same
platform of promotion. So that project will be starting as of this year to recruit this. We have always been having this Teach SA ambassadors in our school. So what we want to do now, we want to give them, provinces are doing that. Certain provinces have already started to do that. But we want to make it a national initiative. So say this percentage of your bazaar, Sundari Shaka bazaar, must necessarily go to your Teach SA ambassador. So we still have to decide on the percentage to cover the gaps in terms of the skills. And obviously, to do that, you can be able to put conditions for them to say, you need to go to your program.
Without repeating what the DDG has already said, I just wanted to quickly highlight the Chairperson asked where we are in terms of trying to define and classify. When we came here before, we did say that there was going to be a research team that will work on trying to define what a rural school is, what rural education is, but moreover also classify, try and deal with the diversity and the inequalities within rural areas and classify those schools, because we know that there are schools that are just very urban, but they are also classified as rural. There are schools in the deep rural areas, and they are also classified as rural. So it might look like there isn't much that we have done, but we've invested a lot of time and energy and finances into trying to make that right, so that whatever happens, once we classify correctly and we define correctly, we will not have the questions that we're having now of saying, of challenges with incentives, challenges with ICT, because we will know exactly what to do and where to do it and which schools to prioritize. I just want to quickly highlight, I got excited by some of the questions because they speak to what we already have in the policy. I can share this because it's going to be gazetted soon and it has been presented to the minister. The issue of incentives, one of the things that came out from consultations is that people don't really want money, but they want improvement in working conditions, they want improvement also in living conditions. Hence the idea that we stole from AgriPark of teacher villages, where we said minister of centers where we're going to provide housing for teachers, provide services, and also provide resources that will make their teaching easier, where they can spend time in the afternoon and prepare for work. So that is what is also included in the policy. And that will also include transport as well. We talked of incentives around professional growth, that people need to be incentivized in terms of positions, maybe when it comes to them teaching in the rural areas. We also talked of using existing resources in the rural area. Hence, we're going to foreground the agriculture, because there is already something that is an advantage or a positive thing in the rural areas, and that will assist in ensuring that the community is involved in schools. So it will be part of trying to mobilize community involvement. And also in our policy, the monitoring and evaluation is very strong, where we're very clear on what is the role of and responsibilities of DPE, the role of PEDs, but we move further and mention the role of districts as well as the role of schools and how we are also going to involve the community around those schools. Another important one, I think, that is also going to cover the issue of multi-grade is the packaging of a package for small schools as well. That small schools should have some kind of a different way of being treated compared to ordinary school. And we will touch on issues of PPN and funding there as well. But of course, it's still subject to public comments and whether that is accepted at the end. But I think most of the questions that were asked will be answered when that is in place.
We also
yes.
Yes.
1st of March. We're just doing the final editing, and we're definitely going to meet the deadline.
Thank you, Department. It is going to respond to the most version with all the questions we are saying, how do we retain best teachers, skilled teachers in those areas, that is, and that's always there, but the policy that you are talking about is going to respond to such, notwithstanding these functions of the provinces and to the universities, even when the policy is there, are they going to be adhering to
honourable members,
then I think we'll have to await for the policy, of which it should be the continuation of this discussion. This, we are talking about a huge percentage of our children from that. So really, once we correct this, once we have everything in place to make sure that the quality public education is not drastically change the landscape of performance in the whole system of the country, and we are going to be doing well as a country. Thank you very much for the presentation. Thank you very much, honorable members, for the good contributions that you have just made. I think we can ask you to give department so that you know what I'm just behind to adopt the means and carry forward for me. Thank you very much. So we haven't been granted permission, but we've already applied.
page one of the set of minutes.
Thank you. But then, honourable members, why is they're doing a follow-up with that one? Really, honourable ladies, as I'm saying, it has been a norm. Will be changed.
never heard people who are asking questions being named that so and so has asked one to perform. Even when you're making a recommendation, I have never seen in minutes say, oh, the recommendation came from whoever. Normally, we the secretary will write minutes so that at the end of the day, we all own up to that particular minute. And when we all own up, it says you can mention names who did 1, 2, 3. Personally, on the personal level, that's how, even when we were doing these communication skills, that's how it came up how to write minutes. But there are specific cases, maybe somebody has sent this one, maybe for them to do, like thanking someone, that is allowed. Or when somebody has to answer for a particular, so that we know who answered on that particular, not special from the department, we have to be specific on that one. That one answered, responded by saying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I think that's the norm.
I also want to support the proposal that you have put forth that should be checked. But if you check even the minutes that the Honorable Venue is referring to, if you are adopting minutes and reports, and then you highlighted the names of people that were proposing for second names and adoption, just like that. I know that. There are instances where we have also raised names of people that raised points in the meeting. But generally, you would find that at the discussion, throughout the discussion, we will not capture them because, like, I think what is professional is for us to capture issues like the final outcome as a collective input of the committee, not to single out individual. So what I think Chairperson has happened in instance where we have singled out action is when, like, say for instance the DA will be captured, like, such and such a person has rejected the minute and state that. So I think it's for purposes of collectivism within the community. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, Jefferson, I'm covered now.
Okay. I'm less honorable basis because for me, what is interesting, with all the minutes that you have been part of the committee, you have never addressed this. I wonder what is it that in this specifically you wanted your name to be, you know, because we need to be honest here. With all of them, really, nothing has come forth of this, and you've been adopting the minutes. But specifically with this one, where there was conversation, processes, the workshop in the person's mind, maybe you can be open enough and say there is a point that you say. Otherwise, we always take all the input, all the discussions, the points from members, and what has been discussed. Because yes, what you are dealing with, you must be clear, you are dealing with your name appearing as to say you said this at your job. Maybe you do have a specific point of interest on that. Why?
Thanks, Chair. I think it's quite interesting because usually the minutes don't talk about a member. In fact, the minutes don't usually specify a specific member at all. They say members. They'll say, so even if I raise a query, the minutes will say members raise this and then they raise that. So the minutes are always generic, they're always general. Okay? These minutes, it says a member took the time to clear the air on this.
I mean, an honorable day is like
moving. But no, I need to say,
I think now we're talking about the time then. Let us correct that and to say a point was arranged. You know? Let us remove a member. Let's say each was arranged. For me, I think that is where it hits a point on a bracket.
That's the
the point that I want to make.
Thank
I just
so
want to
much.
Also say, Chairperson.
Thank you so much.
I'm not looking for fame.
I don't want my name to be there. But really, I think we are now we are aware, because I thought that, honourable members, with that one, with that approach, I fully agree. Can we correct it was raised, because that is what we all are, you know, a point like this, a question was raised, then, yeah, thank you very much, then, for it.
That raise a new problem. If we're going to now say members took the time to clear the air on issues and members queried the moderation process. Now, I'm quite aware that I was the only member of this committee that had these issues. Now, if you're going to say generically that members had these issues, it's going to look like as a collective we all had the same issues. So how do we get around that problem now?
You cannot even say an issue of what queried, you know? But let us agree on this one, honourable members, but I think we're getting to where we want to go to get, you know. Because we don't usually say members did this, members. We only say a certain point was raised, and this was the false response from the department. It was, you know, honourable staff, you wanted to get in.
Okay, I wanted to say that even if a certain honourable member has raised an issue, if we agree as a committee, we happen to own up citing. It's only if we disagree where in a really we'll have to really to say so and so disagree with it. But if we agree, it's collective, then we will say members have agreed on this thing.
No, I would differ with you a little bit there, because it's not about agreeing. It's agreeing on the minute that such a point was raised, which does not translate to the fact that we were agreeing with what honourable caller was raising. You know, the essence of the minutes, we are saying that point was raised and this is how it was responded, because it will reflect on the minute. It does not say the point that was raised is because everyone was agreeing. But we are adopting the minutes to say what is the reflected here. We all agree as to say this is what happened in that meeting. There was a point that was raised. There was a point that was contested. There was a response of this nature. You know. We are agreeing on what transpired on in the meeting as to say these were the points that were raised. This was the explanation that we got. This is how we concluded on the meeting. Not necessarily to say we agree on what has happened, not that one, we can't change that stance, not at all. So I think honourable members, we agree then to say let us rework on that, our support staff, on capturing the essence of the discussion, but not to say honourable Gina said that, honourable Boshoff said that, and that is how it happened. Let us capture the essence and the things that were raised in the meeting.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for that. I was going to say, let me say, honourable members, let us put aside the set of minutes for the 17th. Let us not adopt the set of minutes for the 17th. Up until the rules, but the essence is there, we fully understand, but let us not adopt this, we'll share them and continue to the other day. Let's go to the 21st of February 2017. Teams report on grade 9 and grade 5 performance and the oversight monitoring data school readiness for the year that you are in. And the update on the one situation. Page 1. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Thank you. page 5.
can't find it in the minutes, but I do remember a specific instance where Mr. Governor said that English and Afrikaans were foreign languages. And then we had a discussion about whether English and Afrikaans were foreign languages or whether they were official languages of the Republic. I can't find it in here. I may have missed it, but I do think that needs to be captured here because it did generate some discussion. When he was talking about the short, medium, and long term during his presentation.
Okay, maybe just to say the issue of languages, the foreign languages of English and Afrikaans being foreign, it was clear you did not have just that indication, then it can be a problem. Honorable Porto.
Chair, I know I was not there, but I want to make my input from what I have heard from the colleagues. I think on page 7, if you look there, then the last paragraph, I think it seems to capture the essence of what you are raising, because like really I was not there, but from what I hear on the issue of English and Africans not being local languages, I think it comes from there. Not because the page that Mr. Davis is referring to, it's capturing issues on curriculum, and then I think that's the issue that we really put on the introduction of African language. Thank you.
It's either if it is page 7, it can be on top there, or which was on the other side. But it's fine. You can capture it on page 4 as part of the discussion, something that was built by the members on that one. Just another thing. We agree on the channel, one of the members. We can adopt it with the amendment. Honorable Person.
I move for the adoption of the minutes with the amendments. Thank you. December. Page 1.
nothing, Honorable Members. Honorable David, you have given me a long moment today just to go to various sources of this word, and it's appearing everywhere, and whenever I look at it, I'm becoming very interested. So, you know, there are words that you simply use without that are commonly used, you know, without getting into the, yeah, but as we're saying, we learn every day, because with Mr. Bundy, our support staff, even some of the areas where, you know, we need to check on the correctness of the way that you have written. Number four, page four. Page 18.
adoption. She's moving for the adoption. Okay, thank you, Honourable Davis. Thank you very much, Honourable Members. I'm so sorry with the case at everyone, because it was submitted, it was looked at, and yeah, we just want to give everyone so that you can come up. We adopt it just immediately as we come back together with the public one. Thank you very much again, Honourable Members. So Mr. Brown will be in touch with us. Then we go and hear